listener production.
A warning. This episode references the death of a child and contains graphic descriptions of violence. If this content affects you, dial Lifeline on 13 11 14. G'day, I'm former police officer Brent Sanders. And for the past 25 years, I've dedicated myself to sharing what I've learnt on the force to the Australian public so they can better protect themselves from falling victim to crime. So with the help of some of the most respected current and former detectives and high-ranking law enforcement agents, we're going to pull back the curtain on what life is like on the force and what they've learned about how crime and criminals really work. These are real stories from real detectives. This week, a high-ranking detective who investigated some of the UK's most chilling crimes.
To this day, I couldn't tell anybody what was the actual motive for it. What I do know is it's probably one of the most horrendous crimes that I've been involved with.
Nigel Donoghue joined the South Yorkshire Police when he was just 16. He had a distinguished career and was a high-ranking detective for much of the 32 years he spent in the force. To start, we're heading back to the mid-90s. Nigel's just received an unusual call about the death of a 14-year-old at a dental practice.
It was a particularly unusual case in that we had a young man who got a very rare genetic disorder receiving treatment at a dentist. I got involved when I received a phone call to say that this young man had passed away and it wasn't being treated as suspicious. And my initial thoughts were, how does a young 14-year-old child end up in a dentist and then ending up going to hospital in an ambulance and is dead? It just seemed completely alien. So I ended up going to the scene and having a look at the scene, and we'd had some photographers down before I got involved who'd taken some forensic photography and had a look at it. So I wasn't comfortable that there wouldn't be anything suspicious behind it. I needed to understand a number of things, namely, why was he being anaesthetised at a dentist? What kind of condition did the child have, and what was involved in the whole setup that led it to the tragic outcome that we had? So, having gone to the scene, I decided that we needed to recover lots of equipment, so we forensically dealt with the scene, recovered the anaesthetic equipment, had a look to see what medicines were present, if any, and basically had to start as a layman setting out the parameters of the investigation to see what we were dealing with, because I saw three elements to it. So I split it up into an investigation that looked at the medical equipment, the medicines, and the genetic condition that the young man had. So we had to find out what was Goldenhaar syndrome, what were the medical implications of dealing with someone with that, and what equipment was being used in the surgery that could have perhaps contributed to his death.
When you talk about that Goldenhaar syndrome, that's not something I'm familiar with. Was the dentist aware of that? Should he have been aware of that with the young lad as a patient, or where did that sort of sit?
Yeah, it is a rare condition that leads to disfigurement, and in this young man's case, it affected his jaw and his respiratory tract was narrowed. So had they taken the time to read his medical notes and inquired into the background, which we subsequently found they hadn't done, they would have found that in his medical notes, if he ever had to have any anaesthetic procedures, that should have been done in a hospital environment because of the dangers associated with the narrowing of his respiratory tract. And as it turned out, through the inquiries that we did, it would appear that the anaesthetist in charge of it hadn't read his notes, hadn't referred to those notes, along with a number of failings that we subsequently uncovered. As a result of the investigation, we discovered that there was some negligence involving the medical equipment. I got involved with an agency I'd never heard of called the Medical Devices Agency in London, and took some advice and worked very well with an expert from down there. And basically what we uncovered is that when you're using anaesthetics, you have gas-specific taps associated with gas, so the labelled, and we discovered that the gas taps had been interfered with. So the oxygen tap had been interfered with, as had the nitrous oxide. So when the young man had been put on the anaesthetics, there were a signal that came through a piece of equipment called a pulse oximeter that indicated he was having trouble with his oxygen. And when the anaesthetist stood, who was dealing with him, was flushing what he thought was oxygen, because the taps had been interfered with, they were actually flushing him with nitrous oxide. And the upshot of it all was, every time the indications were his saturation levels were altered, he was getting flushed by an anaesthetist who thought he was flushing him with oxygen, and he was actually flushing him with nitrous oxide, and that poisoned him.
Would the outcome have been different if he hadn't had that genetic disability, or would it have been the same with regards to the flushing with that nitrous oxide?
To be honest, I'm a layman when it comes to terms of it, but what I don't know is if you pump someone full of nitrous oxide, whether you've got a condition that's as severe as Bradley's were or not, eventually, if you keep flushing me with nitrous oxide, you're going to poison me and ultimately seriously injure me. That would be my assessment of it.
Am I right in saying it got as far as both the anaesthetist and the dentist being charged criminally as a result of this?
Yes, but the prosecution against the dentist didn't go ahead. A decision was made to lay his charges on file when the anaesthetist took full responsibility.
And received a custodial sentence?
Yeah, he got 6 months imprisonment.
And what happens with something like that? Again, we're laymen, Nigel. If an anaesthetist is found guilty of what is basically, manslaughter or something along those lines, is he struck from the register once he comes back?
Yeah, and that's exactly what happened.
Career over. Yeah.
Career ended. I mean, his QC at court described him as a decent, understanding, sensitive man who would have been shattered by Bradley's death, and he took all responsibility for what happened. But, it was a tragic case that should never have happened.
Mm.
Mm. And he faced justice, quite rightly so.
Nodge, if I can take you forward to July 2004, you're a detective inspector in Sheffield, and you investigated a very gruesome case involving the discovery of a young man in a roadside ditch. Can you just explain that case and your involvement in it?
Yeah, I was the actual on-call senior detective that particular afternoon. So it was about 4 p.m. in the afternoon. Somebody travelling home down a quiet country lane in a very remote area of Sheffield saw some disturbance at the side of the road. And when I said disturbance, somewhere the grass had been dragged back, and she stopped and actually saw that there was a body in the ditch. It was an off-duty police officer on her way home who lived in that area. So I attended at the scene with a colleague, and the location was near a dam, a reservoir, but very close to the borders of Greater Manchester, Derbyshire, and the extremities of Sheffield and Barnsley. So an extremely rural location. And if I'm honest with you, when I first turned up and saw the body, and you could see instinctively that it was a gruesome murder, I didn't know whether I were dealing with that as a scene or as a deposition site. I literally had all options open because of it just seemed so out of place, and I didn't know, is it going to be something to do with my district? Is it a cross-border crime? Because the demographics of the UK, different forces. Were it something to do with Greater Manchester? Was it something to do with Derbyshire? lots and lots of questions, and you just have to set off with a very open mind and consider all possibilities and see where it takes you. So that was challenging, again, for different reasons. And it didn't help that when we, it was a nice warm summer's evening, when we were starting the forensic side of things, we had a torrential downpour. So that caused me some concerns as well at the time about potential loss of forensic evidence.
Can you just walk us through how that investigation sort of unfolded and came together from there?
Okay, so obviously because I thought it might be potentially a stranger murder or connected to organised criminality, so a on-duty detective superintendent, SIO, was called to the scene. And between that officer and I, we secured the scene. But we got quite a lucky breakthrough very early on of the evening. We came across a rucksack outside the parameters of what had been cordoned off when I'd first arrived. And we found a wallet. And inside that wallet was some identification of a male. And as it turned out later on in that evening, very late on, we discovered the name of that boy, did some family checks and found he was missing from home, and they thought he were out with friends. So that took a bit of a twist on it. The following day, obviously, we kept the scene secure overnight. We got the forensic scientists out from all the different specialisms. The body remained in situ until the following day, and then it was taken for post-mortem examination. So that side of the investigation, the SIO ran the case, the detective superintendent oversaw all the pathology and all the forensic stuff, and the following day I started with all the coordination of the crime scene, the locality, and that extended over a considerable distance, so that was difficult. During the course of the day when we were searching the immediacy around where the body had been found, we also got a phone call from a local farmer to say he'd found some abandoned camping equipment. So it had made the news that we were investigating the suspicious death of someone. And he said he'd found some, I think it were a tent, discarded in his field, and he didn't know whether it were connected, so he rang us up. And that was near to a village that was close by, a place called Bolsterstone. So we got specialist search teams off, so it was gridded. They did all the grid work and systematically searched all the ground. And we deployed, one of the first times we'd actually deployed a blood dog. And the dog went to the campsite. So we started at the campsite where we'd discovered, not far away from the body. And the dog was able to track blood traces. And what it actually did is it tracked a zigzag pattern down to a gate and then back onto the road and took us to where the body had been discovered. And there were three significant areas where there were heavy blood staining. And what that indicated straight away is that an attack had started at that point, and the person who'd been attacked had sustained injuries and was trying to flee the attackers. Bear in mind, this is in middle at night in a pitch black environment whilst being pursued by his assailants who were hacking at him, and it took us all the way down to where he was undoubtedly suffering with significant injuries, and that's where they finally killed him in the ditch.
And am I right that it was whilst they were camping that these three others, I think two young men and a young lady in their late teens or mid-teens, did they steal the eventual weapon from a local farm? Is that sort of how you piece things together?
So effectively, one of the offenders, the gentleman called John Sorden, he lived in and around Bolsterstone and he knew the area well. So Terry Hurst, who was the victim, was left while sleeping in the tent, and we never established what went off, but we believe there might have been some disagreement. Terry stayed behind. Unbeknown to him, he's fallen asleep. Those three walked all the way back to the Bolsterstone village, and there's a church near to the pub. And it's traditional, what you'd say is idyllic Yorkshire countryside and pub. And the graveyard had a shed in it where the local caretaker kept his garden equipment. And in there, there was two sides. There was a big 5-6 foot side and then a big handheld side that he used to maintain. So they broke into there, and the mindset I had is that somebody who lived locally knew that existed and had probably seen or perhaps even been in that building before. So they went back there, specifically stole those two items, which they took back, and they were the items that they used to kill Terry.
For those who aren't 100% sure, scythe is can be a short or a long-handled. It's a tool that's used to cut through wheat and things such as that. I think an image I get is the Grim Reaper, I think, carries a scythe with him. Am I right? Am I on the right track?
Yeah, and people have used that description to me in the past, and that will allow people to visualise exactly what it is. So the long-handled scythe that was traditionally used for cutting wheat years before technology landed, that's exactly what it were. Big 5-6 foot, massive weapon with a very sharp, large blade on it. Tragically, when we discovered him, he also had a plastic bag on his head, and forensic investigation could show that he'd had his head stamped on, and when the body was removed, there was a well underneath his head, several inches deep, to show the ferocity of what had taken place. So which of the offenders stamped on his head, I don't think we ever established. And then the final indignity was the scythe was left embedded through his neck and into his face.
The obvious question, Nigel, I mean, there's a thousand, but one in my mind is, was there any motive that could be established? Was there any reason for such a violent act? Was it a drug-related issue? How did you arrive?
No, it wasn't drug-related. We asked the questions. They've never been fully answered, and to this day I couldn't tell you what was the motivation. There was some suggestion that there might have been a link to the 17-year-old and a girlfriend, and he was jealous of Terry's interest, but that is pure speculation. So to this day, I couldn't tell anybody what was the actual motive for it. What I do know is it's probably one of the most horrendous crimes that I've been involved with, and what makes it doubly horrendous, not that this is minimising it, is how two 17-year-old boys and a 15-year-old could coerce and plan in so much detail to get someone isolated in such a lonely place, and then go in the middle of the night fully intending to steal property that they knew existed, i.e. the sides, and then go back and conduct such an horrendous attack on someone. I don't think I'll ever rationalise what went on in their heads.
Being of that young age themselves as offenders, could I ask, what was the end result with regards to them? Found guilty, all three, varying degrees of culpability, I guess, custodial sentences, but they'd be aligned with their age too, I suppose. What happened there?
Yeah, that's obviously something to take into consideration, along with their reaction and how they responded, obviously. So they pleaded not guilty until they got to the trial date, and then entered guilty pleas. So all three were convicted on their guilty pleas. They got life imprisonment with minimum sentences. So the minimum sentences that were handed out is Mr. Sorden. He was jailed for a minimum, I believe, of 17 years. The other lad, Jermaine James, he got 15 years, I believe it was, and then Rebecca Peters, the 15-year-old girl, she got a 12-year minimum sentence. She did subsequently appeal that some years into her sentence, and it was deemed that she cooperated and had started showing some kind of understanding of what she'd done, was responding to treatment and had started maturing and her sentence, minimum sentence, reduced on appeal to 10 years.
Did you interview any of the three offenders yourself?
No. So because of the nature of the investigation, obviously it was dealt with as a major incident. So Mr. Hardy, the detective superintendent, and I oversaw the strategy and strategic planning, and we brought in expert interviewers, fully trained interviewers. We got the specialist family support people in. My role in that is to ensure strategy is implemented and we've got a good investigative plan laid out, so it's more direction. There were a lot of officers employed on that investigation.
You would be close enough to it, I'm sure, Nigel. When these three children, and that's what they are, they're all under 18, they're legally children, did they show remorse? Did they show degrees of contrition? They pleaded not guilty right up until the death knell. But these are the actions of a psychopath, and oftentimes, Nigel, you'd know better than most that, you know, when you get a group, 2, 3, 4, whatever, committing such a violent crime, you often have one who is of almost psychotic tendencies and the others sort of follow along behind. I'm interested, was there any sort of structure like that within this that you became aware of following the arrest?
It's a term that people bandy quite often, psychopath. And I'm not here to go into the ins and outs of psychopathic behaviour. What I can tell you is that they were subject, whilst incarcerated, awaiting trial, they were subject to reviews by psychologists for all the obvious reasons. And they showed no remorse whatsoever to any of my team. It's only after conviction that one of them, to my knowledge, has shown any contrition and started responding, and that was the young lady. What I can say without a shadow of a doubt is they were callous beyond belief in what they did. Whether or not they officially were diagnosed with psychotic tendencies or psychopaths, I couldn't answer that. But what I can say, it was a cold-blooded, planned, premeditated, horrendous attack with no apparent motive. And even if there'd have been a motive to injure him, to do what they did is just beyond belief.
...2007-2008, you're the senior investigator of an extremely confronting case which involves a fair bit of vigilantism, I think we could call it, for want of a better term. Can you explain this one to us?
Yeah, it's, in a nutshell, a gentleman driving home from work decides he needs to make a phone call to a family member, pulls his car up on an estate and pulls up at the side of the road on a grass verge. And while he's on his phone, he hears a man walks up and taps on his driver's door window. He winds the car window down to be confronted by someone asking him if he's a smack dealer. And that individual then pours petrol from a canister over his head, over the top of the car, crouches down, sets fire to it, and sets fire to the gentleman, who's then trapped in his car. The engine's running, and he's struggling to get the seatbelt unfastened, and he eventually manages to get the seatbelt unfastened when it's burnt through. The car's still gently ticking over, manages to get himself onto the grass verge, and with the assistance of some passers-by, they manage to put the fire out, and the car just rolls a few feet down the road into a tree. And as you no doubt already worked out, he suffered horrific burn injuries.
So the chap's walked across the road. He's seen this guy in a car, perhaps on his phone. What was he thinking that led to him doing what he did? What did he think was taking place on the side of the road?
He'd got it in his head that there were a local drug dealer, someone coming onto the estate regularly and selling drugs, smack being an abbreviation or a term for heroin. He's seen this man on the phone. He's gone to his garden shed, got his can of petrol, walked across the world, casually knocked on the side window and just doused him in petrol, accused him of being in a smack dealer, and then run away with the can and disappeared onto an estate. We subsequently did some inquiries during daylight hours the following day and recovered the petrol canister. But what happened in the early hours of the morning while we were getting the scene secured, the man who was responsible actually surrendered himself to the officers at the scene, where he was arrested for obviously attempted murder. And again, the following day we had to do all the forensic evidence gathering.
Was there any backstory to that individual as to why he did that? I mean, let's say the guy is a drug dealer. Let's say he is there selling drugs. It's still a pretty extreme step to take. The fact that he wasn't, of course, makes it even more tragic. The guy that took that action, did he give any sort of an explanation? Had there been something that happened to a family member or something? What would cause such a reaction like that?
Just he got children and he didn't want drug dealers on his estate. The tragedy of this is, if he'd have been able to find the time to actually contact the police, I had a team of officers in a drug squad, and I got proactive officers who would have targeted that information, developed that information, which is exactly what I had to do. So we have a team tied up with dealing with an attempted murder, and the offside of that was, there's a drug dealer somewhere on this estate who sadly looks remarkably like the victim. So that was the other twist to it. And very quickly, we located who was the person that was involved in drug dealing, and he was arrested and prosecuted and sent to prison.
The guy that was charged with attempted murder, as you said, he's a family man. He's got children and he's just at his wit's end for whatever. He got a 21-year minimum sentence for attempted murder.
Yeah, I actually had a look at a newspaper clip this afternoon before I came in reporting on the case. He was 33 years old, that man. The newspaper reported he'd actually got 24 years, but nonetheless, over two decades in prison as a minimum life sentence. So he's still in prison over something, and this is where vigilantism is something that is the police, we discourage people for all the reasons that this case highlights. You know, don't take the law into your hands. Every little piece of information you're passing, if he'd have come to us with that information, what he didn't know is there might be an intelligence package that we're already working on to develop it from other sources. As it turned out, there were bits of information that we were able to action. And he wouldn't be in prison. The drug dealer got quite a relatively low sentence. I think it was either 6 or 12 months imprisonment. He didn't have to do what he did. He ruined his own life, his own family's life, his family's reputation. He ruined the lives of the poor man who just wanted to catch up with a family member on his way home because he was running late. And I have to ask you, the question, why would you do that? Why would you put yourself in that position? You know, the police are the people to go to. If you've got concerns, go to the police. Pass that information on and let the police try and deal with it. Don't take the law into your own hands. And there's just a catalogue of disaster and heartbreak left behind by people doing what he did.
The gentleman that was in the car, did he make a full recovery as much as you can after something such as that?
Well, obviously, his life was ruined, significant injuries. I'll quote from a reporter's notes who spoke to him. He was specifically asked that question, and his response was, I still have anger inside me. I haven't had time just to sit and think about things. I just want to try and put this behind me and get on with the rest of my life. Not defeatist language, but a resignation that my life has changed and I just need time to reconcile it and come to terms with it. He didn't die. His injuries, obviously, he'll have had numerous skin grafts and, you can just tell that from that comment he's just completely disillusioned and can't understand why this has happened to him, because all he did was pull off a main road onto a side street to make a phone call.
That story, I mean, there's so many elements to it, isn't there? And that vigilantism that you speak about, it's in a case like this, it's just a decision made in a heartbeat that leads to a disastrous outcome. In a 32-year career, you've seen a lot. You chose that story amongst the others. What was your motivation behind choosing that particular story?
I think it's just to highlight a very strong social message, really. It's the police have a difficult job, and they don't always get it right. We know that. But someone's life, a number of people's lives have been changed by people not doing the right thing. It's a strong message. It's a social message that we don't do that because of everything we've discussed. And if you've got that kind of information that you can share, or you've got those feelings, don't act on them, because it's not what's expected. And it's a harrowing story. It was completely avoidable. And, you know, we've all heard people in bars saying what they'd like to do to people, and sadly people get it wrong. And when it does go wrong, it's usually catastrophic. And the messaging I wanted to put across there is, talk to the police, get that message out, speak with people. Don't do something as hideous as that gentleman chose to do.
So, Nigel, after 32 years of service, you're in your late 40s at that time, still a relatively young man. There came time to step away from the job, but it was a set of circumstances that you didn't, the impression I got, you weren't totally happy with it, and perhaps totally not in control of that situation. How'd that come about?
At the time I retired, around 2012, 2013, in the run-up to that, the government were looking at making efficiency savings, and police forces were being asked to make cuts, and the chief constables were looking at how they could make cuts and where they could make savings. There were different calculations being used. What does 5% cut in cost look like? What does 10 look like? What does 20? So a couple of years before I retired, I actually received correspondence from my chief officer asking me what my intentions were, because I was one of a number of officers that were due to come up to 30 years. So 30 years you can retire. And there was a little known regulation called Regulation 33, which is hidden in police regulations, or was at the time, where a chief constable on the grounds of efficiency could order you to retire. So whilst I was told that wasn't going to be implemented, I came at a time of my service and I was looking at the political landscape, and it was at that point I made the decision that I needed to consider an alternative career, because if that was going to be imposed, I'd sooner have choice over my own destiny and future rather than be told you've got to retire. So I started planning for a second career.
And that stepping away from the job in the UK some years later led to a decision, 2018 or thereabouts, I think, Nigel, to come here to Australia. Can you just share with us the role now? Because I think there's an interesting circle back into from your policing career into what it is you're doing now through Charles Sturt University.
Yeah, I mean, it was a fantastic opportunity that was afforded me. So when I made the decision I was going to leave, I planned some further study. So I'd been doing some training to junior officers in our crime training department. So I decided to qualify myself as a teacher, because I found I enjoyed passing on knowledge to junior officers. And I went into higher education. So I got myself a qualification. I then studied a master's qualification in international criminal justice, which I found really interesting. Was working in HE and an opportunity was presented, and I was asked, would I be interested in applying, because there might be some vacancies coming up. It was a colleague I knew who was working out here, and he said, just keep an eye on website, there might be some adverts coming up. And it was no more complicated than that. And obviously, in my early 50s to mid-50s, I looked at the job advert, I got all the requisite skills that they were asking for, I got the experience to come out as a lecturer, and I thought, why not? Why would I not do that and come out on a temporary visa, which was being offered? And I've never looked back since. It's one of the best decisions I've ever made.
Just to clarify, Nigel, that role through Charles Sturt University is you overseeing the School of Policing Studies down there in Goulburn. I may have got the terminology wrong, but that's the sort of role that you're now in.
Yeah. Oh, so initially I came out as a lecturer, so I was teaching on the programme. I'm now, the role is the associate head of school, so I oversee the course of study and make sure that things are running administratively well, that the teaching staff, we're recruiting properly and we've got people with the right skill set, oversee student experience, all that kind of managerial role now, which I really enjoy. And I work closely with the head of school in making sure that we try and get the programme to be the best it possibly can.
Interesting for you with a 32-year career in the UK police, now in such a senior role overseeing the education of Australian police. There must be a lot of similarities, but perhaps some differences as well from the training in the UK.
The major differences, I mean, New Zealand, Australia, full of Commonwealth law, so it's not as daunting as you might think coming across here, because a lot of case law that's used here comes from Commonwealth law and cases I'm familiar with. So the legislation I understood, Australia's got its own nuances and different legislation, but the principles are the same. The only difference between the UK and Australia that I think is noticeable is all police officers in New South Wales are routinely armed. In the UK, they're not. There is a definite need for firearms and a firearm response in the world in which these people are living in. But I'm not a massive advocate of being routinely armed. But that's just me. I'm seen as a bit strange in that respect by my colleagues in Australia.
Nigel, our first guest, who's an ex-UK police officer, 32 years serving the good people of Yorkshire and surrounds. Thank you so much for coming in. Thank you for your service. Thank you for your continued service now here in Australia. And it's been great to meet you. And thanks for dropping in for a chat.
My pleasure. And can I thank Australia for accepting me as the Yorkshire ambassador?
Thanks so much. Thank you. Crime Insiders Detectives is a listener original production. It's hosted by me, Brent Sanders, produced by Ed Gooden, and sound designed and imaged by Link Kelly.